Well, I am Reverend Michael McCormick. My Dharma name is Dewe. And thank you again for inviting me to come back to talk with you. Actually, I should thank Miyabo, but he's not here. He's in Houston. So today, actually, I'm really glad Richard and Douglas are here, because I've been talking about Buddha nature, seems like endlessly, for the last year or so. And today, actually, I'm going to cover some things that I've skipped over at the Faithful Fools meetings that we have on Sundays. So, briefly, at Faithful Fools, we got started talking about Dogen and Dogen's essays and Shobo Genzo. And we were going to talk about Busho, but I decided that first we needed to understand Buddha nature. Just in general, the way Mahayana Buddha generally teaches it. So we went over something called the Uttara Tantra Shastra, which is probably 3rd, 4th century Indian work. And then once we had a good idea of what that treatise was telling us about Buddha nature in general, then we moved over into Busho, Buddha Nature by Dogen, to see how he plays with that. What I didn't do was talk about how this whole teaching of Buddha nature came into East Asian Buddhism in the first place. So when Myo asked if I could come here and give a talk, I said, well, what do you guys want to hear about? And he said, well, nobody ever talks about the way Buddhism was changed when it came into China, came into East Asia. So he suggested maybe I could talk about that. So I thought, all right, you know, people, especially in Zen, you know, people keep asking the question, why did Bodhidharma come to China? But I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about how did Buddha nature come to China? And the answer to that is it was there in the first place. But not in that sense of all beings have Buddha nature, whether they hear about it or not, but in the sense of the idea that people have this innate ability to be wise, selfless, and compassionate was already there. So when the Buddha nature teachings came into China, it was very well received and popularized. So I'd like to talk about that, review that a bit, and then throw it out to you and see what you think about all this. So the first thing is that Buddha nature actually is kind of a late Mahayana Buddhist idea, but you find the roots of it way back. You even find it in the Pali Canon, in the Anguttara Nikaya. I think in the Book of Ones, there is the Buddha says that the mind is clear and illuminated, but it is obscured with adventitious defilements. So there you really find this beginning of this idea that there is a clear, pure mind right from the start, but it's just covered over, and we need to uncover that. And this later got developed into things like the Buddha Tathāgata, the Buddha Suchness, or Buddha Dhatu, the Buddha Element, or Tathāgata Garbha. Tathāgata is another word for Buddha. It means the one who comes, or perhaps it means the one who goes from the realm of truth. But in any case, the one who's coming and going from the realm of truth to this realm of confusion in order to teach and express how things really are. That's Tathāgata. And Garbha could mean either embryo or womb. I rather say matrix, because that kind of holds both ideas at once. You know, something, the container for developing something and what is being developed. It's a matrix. So it's the Tathāgata matrix. And in the Nirvana Sutra of the Mahayana, you find that the Buddha nature is a major theme, that all beings have Buddha nature. And this actually caused a bit of controversy in China when it was being translated by Kumarajiva. The way I understand it is they had translated the first half of the Nirvana Sutra, and that was enough for a monk named Dao Xing, if I'm saying his name correctly, to assert that all beings have Buddha nature. And many of his colleagues said, no, it doesn't say that. You know, it says, you know, maybe they have Buddha nature, but they won't necessarily recognize it. There's the Ichantika, the incorrigible disbelievers who will never get it. And Dao Xing stuck to his guns, or his bows and arrows, I don't know, it's back then. Stuck to his guns and said, no, all beings have Buddha nature. And he was banished from his monastery. And eventually, I think it was like a few decades later, the rest of the Nirvana Sutra was translated. And there were passages there that confirmed Dao Xing's intuition that all beings, in fact, do have Buddha nature, will realize Buddhahood. So that's the Nirvana Sutra. There was another monk. Let's see if I can find his... I have all my names and dates in here. So, excuse me a second. There was a monk from Central Asia named Paramarta. Let's see if I can find this. Yes, here it is. No, I don't want to go on the internet. Paramarta, yes, 499-569. So he was in the 6th century, and he came and was one of the first people to translate many of the teachings of the consciousness-only school. But he was very much interested in spreading the teaching of Buddha nature. So he even wrote a Buddha nature treatise. And he is also credited with translating the, I think it was him, with the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. How many people here have heard of Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana? Just one? Really?
I've heard of it.
Oh.
That's all.
Oh, okay. Okay.
What it is.
Okay. Well, I'm going to discuss a little bit today. So, Paramarta taught that there was a pure consciousness that he identified with the Buddha nature that all people could realize, so that there was no one bereft of this Buddha nature. And the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana is a very was a very famous, very popular treatise in Chinese Buddhism, and especially in the Flower Garland School. Although I think several of the Zen teachers also made reference to it, but it was mostly in the Flower Garland School that was popular. But all throughout Chinese Buddhism, Korean, maybe to a lesser extent in Japan, people discuss this treatise and referred to this treatise. And it is in here that we find this idea that all beings are originally awakened. Actually, that's not true. I take that back. It's in the Flower Garland Sutra that you find a passage where the Buddha, sitting under the Bodhi tree, states, oh, now I see that all beings are awakened, but they just don't realize it. So this treatise really highlighted that. Let's see if I can find the passage here. I thought I had it marked. I guess I didn't. Let's see. Nation of ignorance, interpretation, greatness, suchness. Now I'm not going to be able to find it. I opened it right up to it last night. It's kind of funny. Anyway, there is a passage in here. Oh, here it is. Yeah, I think this is it. Yes, here it is. Where it talks about the original enlightenment that all beings share, and how on the basis of that one can then acquire enlightenment. So the treatise says, because original enlightenment indicates the essence of mind before anything else, in contradistinction to the essence of mind in the process of the actualization of enlightenment, the process of actualization of enlightenment is none other than the process of integrating the identity with the original enlightenment. So we may have this original enlightenment, but we need to realize it and close the gap of alienation that we have from this. It goes on to say, grounded on the original enlightenment is non-enlightenment. And because of non-enlightenment, the process of actualization of enlightenment can be spoken of. So we have this Buddha nature, but it is obscured. We do not realize it. We need to realize it. In realizing, in living the Buddha nature, we actualize it. Or we acquire, it seems like we acquire it, though it was there all along. So this is a funny kind of rhetoric, I think. But Chinese Buddhists found this very inspiring. And it was inspiring because they wanted to know, what is the basis of attaining Buddhahood? Do we really all have Buddhahood? Can we have confidence that our practice will lead us to Buddhahood? Of course, you know, Dogen and other later teachers would say the practice is itself the expression of Buddhahood, but we're not quite there yet. So I'm talking about a little earlier period. The idea that all beings have Buddha nature and can realize Buddhahood was not universal. I already spoke of how Dao Xing was banished from his monastery because he asserted that. Even after this treatise appeared, and after, you know, the Flower Garland School talked about that passage where the Buddha asserts that all beings are awakened but don't realize it. Even after that, there was a school that was established in 7th century China called the Dharma Characteristic School. And that was the Chinese form of the consciousness only, or Yogacara school from India. And does anybody know the monkey story, the story of the Monkey King? So, you do? Okay. Yeah, that's based on a real story. Well, not with a magical monkey. But there was actually a monk, Xuanzang, I think was his name, who is the hero, or one of the heroes of the monkey story. That the monkey's like his protector and brings him to India to get the sutras. But there really was a Xuanzang, and he really did leave China. Actually, he snuck out of China. He wasn't, people weren't allowed to travel back and forth at that time, so he got past the border guards and went into India and spent many years there, I think at Nalanda University, and collected texts and translated, or well, he translated the text when he got back to China. But the reason he did this was he was kind of unsure of some of the earlier translations done by Paramartha and others, and he wanted to kind of double check everything and study with the actual teachers in India. So when he got back to China and began translating the teachings of the consciousness only, or Yogacara school as found in India, he began to assert that in order to attain enlightenment, you need to have pure seeds in your life. You know, pure causes need to be there. And some people have them and some people don't, according to what he had learned from the people in India. And he came up with these five groups of people. There were some who were destined to become arhats, to just escape the six worlds of birth and death. Some who would become Pracheka Buddhas, that means a self, solitary awakened one is what that means, who would realize causes and conditions on their own without any exposure to Buddhist teachings necessarily, and they would escape the six worlds of birth and death. So that's two. And then there were the ones who had the seeds to be bodhisattvas and attain Buddhahood. So there's three. And then there was another group of people who had all of those seeds and could go, they had all the options available to them. They could go anywhere, become an arhat, Pracheka Buddha, Buddha. And then there were these poor unfortunates, the fifth group, who had no pure seeds at all. So the best they could hope for was to be reborn as humans or in the heavenly realm and get some respite from the worst sufferings of the six worlds of birth and death. And there was a lot of controversy between this school and the other schools because, you know, that's kind of a downer that not everyone's going to get it. We don't all have these pure seeds. And yet it was authoritative. This is what the teachers in India were teaching. This is what the translation, the more authoritative or accurate translations of Xuanzang were presenting. And in fact, just as a point of compare, another point of comparison, Xuanzang in the Dharma Characteristics School taught that there were eight consciousnesses. The six senses, or five physical senses, and mind, which is a consciousness of thoughts and feelings. The seventh consciousness, or ego consciousness, that little voice in the back of the mind, we're not always aware of it, that's constantly saying, this is me, this is happening to me, I'm doing this, this is I, me, mine. That's the seventh consciousness. And in the eighth are storehouse consciousness, where all the causes are stored. So he taught only eight, and in Tibetan Buddhism today, they teach only eight. And the reason being that they're getting that direct from the Indian Yogacara school. Paramartha, though, kind of going off on his own, had taught nine consciousnesses. He had taught that in the addition to the eighth consciousness, there is a pure consciousness. So, let me wrap all this up. Basically, there were those in India who, among the Mahayana Buddhists, who talked about Tathagata Garba or Buddha nature, but they don't seem to have been a majority. It seems to have been like one strain of thought and didn't even become its own school. In Indian Buddhism, there is the Majjhimaka, or those who focused on emptiness, dialectics, and then the Yogacara, who focused on consciousness-only teachings. And they taught only eight. And if Xuanzang is, if we can judge by Xuanzang's teachings, they did not think that everyone had this Buddha nature. But in China, it was Paramartha's ideas of the ninth consciousness. It was the awakening of faith's teaching of an original awakening. It was the passage in the Flower Garland Sutra that asserted that all beings are Buddhas but don't realize it, that became popular, much more than in India. So the Tathagata Garba strain of thought was heavily influential in the Flower Garland school, to a certain extent in the Tiantai school later on, in Zen, and what other schools? But anyway, in all the various schools. Why was this? Why did the Chinese pick up on this and promote this so much? And I think it's because they already had this idea previously, even to the appearance of Buddhism in China. Who's heard of Mencius? Mencius, anyone? Yeah, all right, great. I think it's funny, only one person here heard of this, but everyone's heard of Mencius. He was the great successor to Confucius. Actually, a few generations later, I think it was in the grandchild, like two or three generations later. Mencius, let's see if I have my reference here. Not that one. Yes, Mencius was in 372-289, so we're talking 4th, 3rd century BCE. And Mencius went much further than Confucius in teaching that human nature is basically good, and that we do need to educate and cultivate ourselves, but educate and cultivate ourselves to bring out what is naturally within us. Confucius never went that far. And there were other Confucians who did not have such a positive view of human nature. I don't recall their names right now, but there were some who said, well, you know, we could be good, we could be bad, it depends on what happens to us and what we do. And then there were some who just flat out said, people are just bad. You need to whip them into shape. And that's the legalist school came out of that. But the mainstream Confucian tradition in China, and therefore mainstream Chinese culture, preferred Mencius ideas about human nature, that we are basically good, and that education and cultivation is to bring out that basic goodness. I'd like to share a couple passages from Mencius about this, because I think they're very revealing. One is, Mencius said, if people follow their feelings, original nature, it says in parentheses, they will be able to do good. This is what is meant by saying that human nature is good. If man does evil, it is not the fault of his natural endowment. The feeling of commiseration is found in all men. The feeling of shame and dislike is found in all men. The feeling of respect and reverence is found in all men. And the feeling of right and wrong is found in all men. The feeling of commiseration is what we call humanity. The feeling of shame and dislike is what we call righteousness. The feeling of respect and reverence is what we call propriety. And the feeling of right and wrong is what we call wisdom. Humanity, or benevolence in some translations, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom are not drilled into us from outside. We originally have them with us. Only we do not think to find them. Therefore it is said, seek and you will find it. Neglect and you will lose it. So I think there's a saying in Zen, which I suspect might be derived from the Lotus Sutra, that the treasure that comes in through the gate is not the real family treasure. Mencius. Benevolence, righteousness, propriety, wisdom were called the four beginnings in the Confucian tradition. The idea that all people have these innate qualities, but they need to be developed. He also said, all men have the mind which cannot bear to see the suffering of others. The ancient kings had this in mind, and therefore they had a government that could not bear to see the suffering of the people. When a government that cannot bear to see the suffering of the people is conducted from a mind that cannot bear to see the suffering of others, the government of the empire will be as easy as making something go round in the palm. When I say that all men have the mind which cannot bear to see the suffering of others, my meaning may be illustrated thus. Now when men suddenly see a child about to fall into a well, they all have a feeling of alarm and distress, not to gain friendship with the child's parents, nor to seek the praise of their neighbors and friends, nor because they dislike the reputation of lack of humanity if they did not rescue the child. From such a case, we see that a man without the feeling of commiseration is not a man. A man without a feeling of shame and dislike is not a man. A man without the feeling of deference and compliance is not a man. And a man without the feeling of right and wrong is not a man. The feeling of commiseration is the beginning of humanity. The feeling of shame and dislike is the beginning of righteousness. The feeling of deference and compliance is the beginning of propriety. And the feeling of right and wrong is the beginning of wisdom. Men have these four beginnings, just as they have their four limbs. Having these four beginnings, but saying that they cannot develop them, is to destroy themselves. When they say that their ruler cannot develop them, they are destroying their ruler. If anyone with these four beginnings in him knows how to give them the fullest extension and development, the result will be like fire beginning to burn, or a spring beginning to shoot forth. When they are fully developed, they will be sufficient to protect all people within the four seas, or the world. If they are not developed, they will not be sufficient even to serve one's parents. And then finally, let's see, is that last one? 4B26. Mencius said, all who talk about the nature of things need only reason from facts, and principles will be clear. The fundamental principles of reasoning from facts is to follow their natural tendencies. What I dislike in your wise men is their forced reasoning. If those wise men would only act as you did when he diverted the water to the sea, there would be nothing to dislike in their wisdom. You diverted the waters. He was one of the ancient kings who was credited with first taming the Yellow River for agriculture. You diverted the water as if you were acting without any special effort, for he followed the natural tendencies. If wise men would act without any special effort, such as forced reasoning, their wisdom would also be great. Heaven is high and the stars are far away, but if we investigate the facts, we may go back to the solstice of 1,000 years while we sit. So when I came across these passages, I was just fascinated. I was like, wow, that sounds just like Buddha Nature Discourse. You know? And not only does it have a very positive view of human nature, but it's very grounded. Very grounded. And just being oneself. And just, as he says of you, just naturally taming the river and not forcing it. You know, not building dams, but I guess he used embankments or trenches or things to just kind of gently alter the flow of the water. He uses the example of someone seeing a child fall into a well, and that instinctive response to help. So, if I were to, there are so many ways in which Buddhism changed as it came into China. But looking at the issue of Buddha nature, I would say one of the ways, significant ways in which Buddhism changed when it came into China was that the Chinese emphasized that positive strain of Tathagatagarbha that emphasized that all beings have Buddha nature. The Chinese emphasize that this is our natural Buddha nature is our natural endowment. It's who we really are, as opposed to something we need to make ourselves into. And finally, in China, and then thus also in Korea and Japan, Buddha nature is presented not as some kind of esoteric doctrine or mystical, you know, reality, but as something very almost plain and ordinary, something that can be realized just in daily life, you know, in our instinctive response to commiserate with others, to protect a child, to just sit and be aware, as Mencha says in that last passage about sitting and all the stars are in their place. So I think that's about all I was planning on saying, and hopefully that was coherent. And now, let's see, how much time do we have? Until 40, right? 40, 50?
Sure.
Okay. So I'd like to throw the ball back out to you and see what your thoughts are about Buddha nature.
Yeah, yes. I was thinking, as I was listening to, I understand the ancient Indian society was very hierarchical in nature, a caste structure.
Right.
And it seems that as it went into China, the ideas of Buddhism maybe needed a little more democratization. Is that what happened here? Or part of what happened here?
That's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought of that. But, you know, in fact, yes, in India you have this caste structure, Brahmins, the priests, the Kshatriyas, or the... I guess you could call them aristocrats or warrior nobles. Then you have the Vaishyas, who were the merchants. You know, they basically owned everything, right? The cattle and the fields, and then you have the Shudras, who were the servants. So you have this structure. Now the Buddha had nothing to do with that. The Buddha was in fact very critical of it. Now he didn't go on any social reform crusades, but he basically made fun of. Well, not made fun, but he any Brahmin who came to him presuming on the superiority of their birth, the Buddha would quickly show them that, you know, birth was not the critical thing, but the qualities that one lived by, and that these were qualities that anyone could develop. However, even though there was no caste system within the Sangha, and even though the Buddha was critical of the caste system, I think it is true that many monks were Brahmins, and especially those guys at Nalanda University when Xuanzang went there. And within Buddhism, you find this idea of gotra, which means lineage. You know, so you start off being an ordinary person, confused, full of greed, hatred, delusion. But then when you have a moment of real insight that starts to cut through all of that, some Buddhist texts say your gotra changes, your lineage changes, and now you're part of the lineage of the Buddhas. Now you are a child of the Buddhas. You know, so I can't help but wonder if some of that rhetoric was brought in by some of these Brahmins, you know, and especially this idea that some people have the seeds and some people don't. You know? But in China, you don't have a caste system. You know, you certainly have classes of people. I don't think there's been a society on earth that didn't have a class system. But there was this idea in China, and especially promoted by Confucius, that anybody can be educated. And anybody, I think it's either in Confucius or Mencius, there's this statement that anybody can be a Yao, or anybody can be a Shun. And these were the ancient sage kings. You know, so the shoemaker down the street could be a sage king. You know, all they need to do is bring out their original endowment of these positive qualities, educate and cultivate themselves. And when Confucians say educate, they don't mean like learning a lot of information. I think that they mean cultivation of one's benevolence, righteousness, ability to discern what's the correct thing or incorrect thing to do in any given situation. We're talking more of a moral education, more of an education in managing, you know, a business or a country. So I think that it's not exactly an egalitarian idea. It's more of a meritocracy that you find in China. But there is at least this idea that anybody can opt into the meritocracy if they make the effort and dedicate themselves and are educated. And in fact, Confucius apparently was one of the first people who did not restrict himself to just teaching the nobility of ancient China, of the Zhou dynasty, but just wandered about gathering students, you know, from any strata of society and just teaching whoever wished to be taught. And so I think there's something to what you're saying, you know, that the Chinese really did not take to this idea of, you know, people have these distinct natures, but that there's this one nature that can be cultivated and developed. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes?
The quote you gave about the, was it Confucian quote about the government and how a good government feels for the suffering of the people.
Yeah, Mencius, right.
And when you said that, I couldn't help but wish that our current government held that same feeling. Yeah. And then second, I know Buddhism has many lists, the way we've inherited it. Like,
right.
And so you did the Arahat, the Kaitika Buddha.
Right,
the
Bodhisattvas.
So I've been thinking lately about the Arahat, because I'd never really unpacked that before. I just thought, oh, the Arahat, they're, you know, bad, or you know, they're not thinking of the benefit of all beings.
Right.
But I have a feeling there's something more to them.
There's much more.
More, and it's not, because I've been hanging out with the Theravada and Theravadan people lately, and they said, no, actually, it's a choice at a certain point to become a Bodhisattva, you know, to become a Bodhisattva, but it's not something when you're new to Buddhism, you don't go, oh, take the Bodhisattva vow, and you know, it's like, it's, you have to wait till the practitioner matures.
Okay, let me start to address that. That's bringing up a lot of issues. That's also what Mahayana teaches, you know, that there's could be a choice, or at least certain forms of Mahayana would teach that, and especially earlier forms of Mahayana Buddhism, you know, that you can choose which track you want to go on. The word arhat, though, it means worthy one, and I think it specifically means one worthy of offerings. Now, the Tibetans have translated it with a different etymology. But I forget what all that is. But as far as I know, the Pali word means worthy of offerings. And arhat is actually used in connection with the Buddha. The Buddha is also an arhat. You know, there's like 10 titles for a Buddha. Buddha, Tathagata, arhat, world-honored one, teacher of gods and men. There's like a list of 10 fancy titles. And so the only difference between the arhats like Shariputra, Mahakasyapa, and the others, and the Buddha as an arhat is the Buddha awakened without a teacher, at least in that lifetime.
So he's like a pratika too?
No, because a pratika Buddha becomes enlightened on their own, but they don't teach. They remain like hermits, or at least they don't have the qualities needed to start the wheel of the Dharma rolling. So the Buddha is different from the arhats and the pratika Buddhas in that, unlike an arhat, he has no teacher. Unlike a pratika Buddha, he actively goes out and teaches. I've often said, when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and got enlightened, that actually wasn't the point in which he became the Buddha. Because if he had done nothing else after that, he would have been just a pratika Buddha, you know, a solitary awakened one. What happened was that he then got up, considered whether he should bother to teach all beings, and then according to the story in the sutras, you know, Brahma comes and says, please, out of compassion for the many, teach this, because there are some who will be able to understand. At that point where the Buddha made that decision to get up and walk and begin teaching, then he was really the Buddha. See? So what happened, though, was I think that within a few generations after the passing of the Buddha, some people started restricting the idea of the arhat, you know, to just some scholastic who analyzes people into dharmas, you know, and thinks about the selflessness of all things and just kind of focuses on their own liberation which in one sense is a more humble and realistic idea. You know, why presume that I can awaken anyone else when it's hard enough just to be awake and liberated myself? But other people said, well, your interpretation of the arhat is too narrow. You know, your idea of what an arhat is missing the compassion and the engagement that you see in the actual arhats. If you read the Pali Canon, Shariputra and Maudgalyana and the others, you know, they weren't just sitting in caves ignoring people. You know, they were actually out teaching too. And they were actually quite compassionate and helpful to their fellow monks and to other people. So Mahayana, as Mahayana arose, I think instead of trying to rehabilitate the idea of the arhat, they instead started castigating that ideal as it had come to be understood and promoting the bodhisattva instead. You know, being an arhat actually is quite a big deal, you know, because there are actually 10 fetters that bind us to suffering. And the arhat is an arhat because they've broken through those 10. You know, what have they broken through? When I read about these and started considering them, I realized, wow, that's quite a tall order, just that. Never mind being a bodhisattva. You know, these 10 fetters are the belief that there is a substantial self, an independent, fixed self. To break through that belief is breaking through the first fetter. To have the idea that rites and rituals by themselves, some external practice, you know, will bring about enlightenment. That's another idea that they break through. To have doubts about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and especially the law of cause and effect. In fact, Dogen wrote a whole essay about deep belief in causality. That kind of debilitating doubt that makes us hesitate or wonder or not follow through on practice to see, you know, whether it actually pans out or not, that kind of doubt is broken through. And greed and hatred are broken through. So that's a lot. I don't know if I could claim to have totally broken through those 5 fetters. And then there's 5 more where you break through clinging to the idea that you will have some refined heavenly existence in the planes of form or formlessness, restlessness, conceit, and the fundamental ignorance that creates our experience of life as dual, subject-object. You know,
so those breaking are the, through all that, to me it seems that they break through the idea that there's a substantial or a self, then they would be realized with Buddha nature or with all beings.
There you go.
So, but
right.
When they say never returner,
right,
maybe they just get absorbed into the hive or something.
The hive mind, yeah. Well, yeah, there is the idea that Mahayana says that there are 2 hindrances. The arhats break through one, and the bodhisattvas break through the next one. What the arhats break through is the defilements and wrong ideas or wrong views, especially pertaining to the idea that there is a self. But they get rid of the idea of the self, and then there's just kind of this inert selflessness. And you also find that in, like, the Heart Sutra, for instance, you know, or the Diamond Sutra. You break through the idea of self. But if you just went by that alone, you might not be motivated to then re-enter the world of causes and conditions, working proactively. That's more like what the Flower Garland Sutra does. So the idea is that the bodhisattvas break through a second hindrance, which is the hindrance of knowledge. And what this hindrance of knowledge breaks through is the not just the idea that there's a self, but the idea that there are dharmas, little bits and pieces of reality that are disconnected, and then one sees emptiness, that in fact there is no barrier to interconnection. It's all totally interpenetrating, you know. So then you positively can't just think, oh, there's enlightenment for only this stream of causes and conditions. It has to be all. So the idea in the Lotus Sutra, for instance, is that there's really only one vehicle, that the arhats and Pracheka Buddhas, if they really have a deep insight into selflessness, will then also have an insight into that no barrier to the connections between all beings, all things. and they will enter the one vehicle that leads to Buddhahood. You know? So at a certain point, it might seem like you have an option, but if you go far enough, it just merges. See?
Thank you.
Welcome. Thanks. Any other comment? Anything? I guess I have another couple. How much time?
However much.
Oh, yeah. We can always go upstairs anyway.
Yeah. I think I just want to end then by talking about Dogen and Nichiren briefly and how they treat Buddha nature. Because Buddha nature can really seem quite speculative. You know, and studying Buddha nature sutras and treatises can be maddening. I mean, really mad. They're very contradictory, and the rhetoric is very, very flowery sometimes. It can be quite suspect at other times. You know, I wonder if it's not so much that they're trying to present this teaching in a logical way, but just as a bold assertion. You know, which is nice in terms of practice, because the point is to motivate practice, not fill your head with some new idea. But Dogen and Nichiren in the 13th century really wanted to provide people with a way to relate to this in a concrete, practical way, and not just as a form of rhetoric to assert or some speculative idea to hold on to. You know, so in Dogen's writings, you know, we're at Faithful Fools, we're looking at Busho now, Buddha nature, and his other writings, you really see him saying that Buddha nature is really only real in the moment of practice. Buddha nature is nothing if not the totality of all things, which is experienced fully in your practice when you're sitting. Nichiren, the founder of the tradition I belong to, taught that Buddha nature is the encounter with the Dharma. Buddha nature is upholding the Dharma, giving voice to the Dharma. You know, he gave voice to it as Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. So I find that with both of them, with Dogen and with Nichiren, that they wanted to move people away from just thinking about Buddha nature as a theory into an actual encounter or expression of Buddha nature in the moment of practice. And I think that's the most helpful thing. And perhaps in the transition of Buddhism from India to China to Japan, that's the most amazing thing, that you move away from rhetoric, speculation, you know, logic that the Brahmins turned Buddhist monks enjoyed, into something very down to earth, very concrete, very simple and in the moment. It's sitting upright. It's praising the Dharma, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. And that's not to say that, you know, in India people didn't practice, because they did. But it's a matter of emphasis, a matter of what you want to underscore and point to, and how you present that immediacy, that gut experience of Dharma. So I think I'll end with that, on that note. So thank you all very much.